It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with economist Emily Oster about her new book, Expecting Better, which deals with the rules of pregnancy, what is folklore, and what's actually important to know.
And we want to hear from you. How did you navigate all the difficult decision-making? Did your decisions come from the latest science or the data points or traditional pregnancy wisdom? And how did you feel about navigating that line? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to the calls right now. We've got Marie with us from Merrill. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I'm a retired nurse practitioner. I did lots of obstetrical work. I still keep up to date. I respect our professor and her economics background. I respect her research, and she's not going to like some of my next few statements, but I really question, when you decide to become a mother, it's a commitment for the next 23 years, if not for the rest of your life. And for listeria and caffeine, and she didn't mention smoking and alcohol and whatever else the restrictions are, to be such a big deal for her during pregnancy, I really question that. You know, when you decide to become a mother or a father, there's lots involved. You know, so if you can't give up that deli sandwich for 9 months, if you can't give up, you know, even to say, well, let's see, I think 2 glasses of wine a week are okay. Is it really that important? You know, and she may say, yes, it's that important, but you know, and that's fine that she's doing all this research, but she's an economist.
All right. Well, thank you for your comments, Marie. Appreciate your perspective. And Emily, I have a feeling you want to answer that.
I mean, I think what I would say is that I think for many women, yes, you could give up a deli sandwich, but sometimes you would like a deli sandwich. And I think that part of this is saying, look, in all of these cases, we would like to evaluate the risks. And the truth is that every day you're living with some risk of getting listeria. I mean, that's an unfortunate statement. There was a huge outbreak of listeria in celery. There was one in cantaloupe. And so all the time we're living with those risks. And I think then you really need to kind of take a step back and ask the question, how much am I changing my risk by avoiding the deli sandwich? And the truth is, in that case, you know, not very much, maybe not at all. And so I think there, all I'm trying to suggest here is that exactly because we all care about making these choices in the best way possible, and we all care so much about this experience, you want to approach it from a place where you're trying to get all the facts and evaluate all the risks so you know which things, like smoking, you really do want to avoid because they're very dangerous, and which things, like an Italian sub, are not actually dangerous.
And I suppose part of what Marie is getting at is that it might be easier to have a consistent-ish message for all women. There might be language barriers, socioeconomic differences. And if we just say, yeah, stay away from deli meat, it's easier to process than once in a while, it's not too bad, and turkey is more harmful than ham. You know, it's more easier to get a message across.
No, I think that's right. But I think you also run up against the fact that when you get pregnant and you hand people a list of foods that they're supposed to avoid and there are 50 things on the list, it's a little – and or you tell them, you know, don't never have a glass of wine, don't have any coffee, don't smoke. You run the risk that people don't – that it's sort of like, well, I already had this deli meat, so I might as well have some soft cheese, and when in fact unpasteurized soft cheese is much more dangerous. And so I think part of identifying the things that are actually risky and the things that are not is helpful in these situations in which there's a lot of confusing advice. Now, that's separate from saying there are some things where maybe our recommendations should draw more of a bright line because that is an easier thing to process. And I think there are certainly times in which that's appropriate.
What about something like, to go into another area here, amniocentesis, which is, you know, not a lifestyle thing, but it can be a more serious choice in that it can induce miscarriage, but also give you a lot of information. What did you find out about that?
Yeah, so this is exactly, I think this is the real value here of the data, that there are some choices like an amniocentesis where you actually have to choose whether to do it or not, and there's no kind of just avoid it option. Or just avoid the choice. And so there, you know, you're trading off basically an amniocentesis or more commonly now a CVS test, will give you a lot of information, like usually perfect information about whether your child has a chromosomal problem, but it carries some quite small risk of miscarriage. And so what I try to do in the book is both, you know, give women a better sense than at least I felt like I had of exactly how much information that provides over and above other, you know, non-risky options, and also what the risks are, and then try to explain that the right way to evaluate this is to think about how do you feel about the risk of miscarriage as opposed to the risk of a child with a chromosomal problem, and that, in fact, like, that's something which every individual mother is going to think about differently, and it's not something where a rule about all women over 35 should do one thing and all under 35 should do another is appropriate.
Now, you used a lot of your research on your friends and helped them out because you had a lot of friends who were pregnant at the same time. Did you see women picking and choosing this data and coming to different conclusions?
Yeah, almost all the time. So, like, a good example of this is the epidural. So I did all this research, and I basically came to decide with the epidural, there's like a huge benefit to the epidural, which is it's really very painful to have a baby, and the epidural is really effective at relieving that pain. But there are some small downsides associated with making the process of labor more complicated. It's slightly longer. There's this increased use of forceps or a vacuum extractor. So there's like some small downsides. And so I looked at that and I decided, you know what, I'm not going to have the epidural. I had many friends who looked at that and decided, like, this, like, please sign me up. I want the epidural. And I think that's kind of exactly what data like this is for, is to help you think about these choices and decide, you know, where do I fall? What are the things that are going to work out for me?
Are you hoping that your book will help women have more choices, feel that they're more in control of their own destinies as pregnant women?
Yeah, and just feel better about the choices that they do make. I mean, I think this is a time which is, like, incredibly exciting and happy, but also really anxiety-provoking. And I think that for many people, there's a lot of time spent kind of trying to figure out what the right thing is to do. And I think my hope is that if people read this, at least some of those steps will be done for them, and that they will feel, when they've made these choices, they'll feel more confident and relaxed about them. And, you know, I think that's ultimately the goal.
And how did your pregnancy turn out? Were you happy with the choices you made, or were there some where you thought, you know, I wish I would have had more information then?
For the most part, I think I was happy. I mean, I think I might have done some of this prenatal testing stuff a little differently. But, you know, for the most part, I did the research while I was pregnant, and so I was able to kind of use it in my own pregnancy. And so I think, you know, I was pretty happy. The main thing I would do differently next time is I would have already written the book so I could spend more time, you know, not researching things on the internet on the weekends.
All right. Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Emily Oster, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago, and she's the author of the book Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know.
Now we'll check the headlines, then we'll be back with a discussion about whether Wisconsin should lower the drinking age, and we'll hear your thoughts on the topic too. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
And that speech from President Obama, NPR coverage, is tomorrow night at 8 o'clock.
Now that Badger football season has started, we're hearing reports of extreme binge drinking.
Students with soaring blood alcohol levels are being picked up by police outside the football stadium, sent to detox, even though alcohol isn't sold there at Camp Randall.
This led Christian Schneider to write an op-ed for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this weekend in support of Wisconsin lowering its drinking age.
We want to hear what you think about this idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin should lower its drinking age? Why or why not? Do you think lowering the drinking age would help get rid of the college drinking culture, the youth drinking culture? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Christian Schneider joins us now. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So was it this big college binge drinking you've been reading about that led you to tackle the drinking age issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I had been thinking about. It almost sounds crazy to talk about now. I mean, since we're so used to the 21 drinking age, but, you know, back in the 1980s, this was actually a pretty huge issue, and most people were against raising the age up to 21. So, but yeah, these last, you know, slate of, you know, you'll find I guess last week they found two women around the stadium that flew over a .30. One of them was passed out and could have died unless somebody had called the 911. And it just seems like just last this week, as a matter of fact, twice as many students were arrested for underage drinking as were the week before. So that has forced a lot of college university presidents to think, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. I mean, you know, we're forcing these people out of bars where there's actually supervision and into these house parties where there really is no supervision. There's no licensed bartender there to tell them, you know, you've had enough, or to call them a cab to get home. And it's basically, you know, for 19 and 20-year-olds, essentially prohibition, where you're pushing everything underground where it's unregulated. I mean, I think we've seen that students are going to drink, and Lord knows, you know, alcohol on campus is not a new thing. I certainly partook in my time, but it does seem to be getting worse.
Well, do you think this is going to strike some people as counterintuitive? Kids are drinking too much, or kids, people 18 to 21 are drinking too much, so let's lower the drinking age?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially why it hasn't been changed. But I think what you're having is people grow up and they don't know how to drink. We're just kind of throwing them out into the world and saying, here you go, be adults. But, I mean, I think at some point, you know, they actually have to learn how to be responsible and be in public and drink. And as I said, you know, they're doing so in places where, you know, it might be I have to drink as much as I can, because if I leave this house, there might be no chance for me to get my hands on alcohol anymore. So they try to drink as much as they can, you know, before they get to the Badger game, and then you end up with the situation like we've had the last couple of weeks. And of course, you know, I use the example of the woman at the University of Iowa game who blew a .341 and was arrested trying to run onto the field and was live tweeting her arrest. So
and tweeted that she was going to get .341 tattooed on her,
right? Because it was so epic.
So epic. Well, you mentioned the university presidents. You wrote about the Amethyst Initiative. Well, what is that, and who signed on?
That's an initiative where a bunch of college professors got together and they decided, look, this isn't whatever is going on here isn't working. We need to do something different. And they are in favor of lowering the drinking age. Duke University and Dartmouth and Ohio State, you know, some big universities like that have joined on. I couldn't find any universities in Wisconsin that have joined that. But yeah, I mean, they're kind of railing against the quote unquote clandestine drinking that goes on campuses, and I think they'd like to be able to take more responsibility for, you know, the drinking that their students are doing. So, you know, here on the UW-Madison campus, if they were able to serve alcohol to students, you know, 19 and 20-year-old students on the terrace, for instance, you wouldn't have students get ripped at home and then show up and cause trouble while they're there. So I think that's kind of the impetus for why they want to, you know, rethink all of this.
But why, I mean, going back to the 80s, we had the National Minimum Drinking Age Act at the federal level that kind of strongly pushed states to take up the higher drinking age. What was the impetus for it back then?
Well, back then people were worried about, you know, drunk driving deaths, that too many students were on the roads, too many young people were on the roads. But in large part that was because you had different laws in different states. So, for instance, in, I think, Illinois went to a 21-year-old drinking age in 1980, while it was still 18 here in Wisconsin, which, I mean, to me, even an 18-year-old drinking age seems kind of weird, because in high schools you had, you know, kind of these roaming parties during school in these parking lots, since some seniors were 18 years old. In 1983, they moved that up to 19, but still you had the problem where it was higher in Illinois. So you'd have all these kids driving over from Illinois just to drink in Wisconsin, and they'd getting in their cars and driving back, which caused a real problem. That was kind of the impetus for the feds to kind of say, okay, well, we need an across the board drinking age, and they made it 21. The Mothers Against Drunk Driving was very active in that at the time, and President Reagan had said he opposed it, but changed his mind and signed it into law. And Wisconsin fought it as long as they could. Governor Tony Earle at the time said he was against it, but the lure of losing $7 million in federal money got to be too much, apparently. And so he eventually signed it into law in 1986.
Well, on a related topic, we posted this question on the Central Time Facebook page. James wrote, in answer to should Wisconsin lower its drinking age, he says, only if the national minimum drinking age law is repealed, we can't afford to take the hit on federal highway funds otherwise. Talk about how, if Wisconsin changes the age, what's at stake, what we could lose.
Yeah, well, that's what the law did. It withheld federal funds. It essentially blackmailed states into changing their laws. The state could change it if they want, but they would lose 5% of their federal highway funding in the first year and 10% for every year subsequent to that. You know, I've heard proposals where, and I think it's a pretty good proposal, where for 19 and 20 year olds, you have a either make it part of their driver's license or have a separate, you know, quote unquote drinking license, where if you pay money and take an alcohol safety course and of course absolute sobriety on the roads, that you would be able to drink in the state. That would mean that the people that want to come over from Illinois as they normally would, you know, if you're underage from Illinois, then your home state laws would apply to you. If you're underage and drinking in Wisconsin, you'd be able to present your card and you'd be in the clear. I mean, obviously not if you're drinking or if you're driving, but just if you're drinking. So, and some of the revenue from that, I think, would be able to make up some of the revenue lost by the federal government. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, do we want to live under the laws as we want them, or are we willing to be blackmailed by the feds? And, you know, that's something we have to decide.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Pat on the line in Green Bay. Pat, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I am a child of the 18-year-old drinking age.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we started drinking a lot earlier than that. However, I lost my oldest son to alcohol. Excuse me. And this to take and raise it because people don't know how to drink, I'm sorry, but we as parents need to do a better job in bringing our children up so that we don't have these problems. And I'm not sitting here and I'm not saying, you know, we need to teach our kids how to drink, but we need to teach our children the responsibility behind alcohol. It's a huge responsibility.
Pat, thank you for your call, and I'm sorry for your loss. His point, I think, it really doesn't matter so much what the drinking age is if we don't teach the kids responsibility if they're drinking legally or illegally.
Right, and I'm sorry too, Pat, but essentially I think what we're doing is we're taking kids who are 18, 19 years old and kind of throwing them out into the world without any parental involvement, and they're having to figure this out on their own. And, you know, they are drinking right now. I mean, it's not like I don't believe more students are going to start drinking because the age is lower. I've never heard anybody say we shouldn't drink because it's illegal. It's illegal, so we shouldn't get caught, essentially. So I just think there's a more responsible way to do this.
Time for one more call before we go to news. We've got John with us in Windsor. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a unique perspective since I had two 21-year-old Swiss gentlemen that stayed with me for the last 2 weeks, and they've been drinking in bars since they were 16, wine and beer, and they're just appalled at what goes on in this country. In Switzerland, there's a 0.05 blood alcohol rate for driving drunk. There's a no tolerance there. You know, kids are taught responsibility. And I'll tell you, the other thing that the guys were saying is that, you know, the big thing in the United States is we don't have mass transit here. Kids in Europe, what they do is if they go out, they make sure that they're taking mass transit so they're not driving drunk and stuff. And, you know, I think that that's one of the big things that's wrong with our system as well, along with this whole binge drinking culture that we grew up with.
Thanks a lot for the call. And Christian will give you a chance to respond after the news. Okay. I'll remind people now, Christian Schneider's with us. He wrote a column in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel saying, hey, it may be time to lower the drinking age in Wisconsin.
And what do you think? Should Wisconsin lower its drinking age? Why or why not? And do you think lowering the drinking age would help get rid of the college binge drinking culture? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our discussion now about lowering the drinking age in Wisconsin. That's what our guest is advocating. Christian Schneider is a columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Do you think lowering the drinking age might actually help the binge drinking problem at colleges and among other people in that age range? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Before we get to more calls, Christian, just before the break, our caller was saying, hey, he heard the experience from some 21-year-old guys in Switzerland. They'd been at bars since 16, earlier drinking age, but they did enforce those a lower blood alcohol limit. What do you think?
Right. In here in the U.S., we have we're one of maybe just a couple that have a 21-year-old drinking age, and people are more hands-on there in teaching, kids how to drink and how to be responsible. I mean, it's amazing to me, and one of the things that I mentioned in the column is that, at age 18, we expect so many things of these kids to be an adult. You can get married, you can sign contracts, you can serve in the military, you can, to steal a line, you can buy a shotgun, but you can't shotgun a beer. So at 18, you're an adult in all these respects, just you can't sit down and, have a drink. So, I think we should expect our kids to be, our young adults to be adults at that age.
Back to the phones now. We have Joseph with us in Madison. Joseph, hi.
Hi.
What do you think about this?
I have a unique perspective. I am a student from the local tech school to the UW-Madison. And as a result, I spent my first 2 years of college living with my parents. And while this was kind of inconvenient, it meant that I actually had relatively easy access to alcohol. I can drink with my parents in Wisconsin, and sometimes I would do so. But I didn't drink very much. It was under controlled circumstances. I might have a beer with my dad, but nothing big. And when I got to the UW-Madison, I was horrified to see people who would go from the dorms where they could have no liquor at all, would go to a house party and would drink more in one evening than I would in 3 weeks. I would go to events. I would have a drink beforehand at home and take the bus. Other people would be outside shotgunning a bottle of whiskey.
And do you think the drinking age being 21 is a contributor to that?
I think so. As you suggested, it creates a scarcity culture. When something is that unobtainable, when people get access to it, they massively overindulge.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Joseph, and nice to have both perspectives, the home life and at UW-Madison. Christian, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. You're probably not going to find a whole lot of people shotgunning whiskey in a bar where there are, bars have to be licensed, and they could lose their liquor license if anything like that were to happen. So yeah, I agree with that. I think people do a lot more drinking when they think that, they're going to have to get it done, all at once in order to carry them through most of the night.
Thanks for the call, Joseph. We'll go now to George in Kenosha County. Hi there, George.
Hi. How are you?
Well, good. What's your take on this?
I'm a child of the 70s. The arguments that the gentleman is using are the same ones that were used to change the 21-year-old law to 18. And I drank. As I got older, I joined the fire department in Kenosha County. And we could count on going out 4-5 nights out of the week and accidents that involved drunk teenagers. The stretch of Highway 83, south of Highway C to the state line in Kenosha County, used to be called Blood Alley for all of the accidents and fatalities that involved Illinois kids getting drunk in Wisconsin and driving back to Illinois. I don't think it's a good idea. When we had that kind of freedom, we abused it.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, George. Christian, what do you say to that?
Yeah, that was one of the main arguments used when Governor Tony Earle at the time opposed the 21-year-old raising of the drinking age. He said, I oppose it as long as we can keep the kids from Illinois driving up to Wisconsin to drink, meaning, you know, I'll oppose it as long as we can make sure that the drinking laws of Illinois apply to the kids from Illinois. And I think there are ways of doing that. I think, if you're an Illinois resident, it doesn't apply to you. As I mentioned before, if we had, like, some kind of verified drinking license for kids 19 and 20 here in Wisconsin, if you didn't have one, if you weren't a Wisconsin resident, then it wouldn't apply to you. And I think we can slow that down.
So if I'm 19, I'm from Illinois, I show my Illinois driver's license at a Wisconsin bar, as you see it, I'm out of luck. No drink for me.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for the call, George. We've got Eric with us in Milwaukee. Hi there, Eric.
Hello.
What do you think of this?
Personally, I, as someone that's of the age, I'm 28. When I turned 21, I had a DUI, and there's a lot of reasons why people do want to lower the age so that when people hit 21, they don't just start binge drinking. I believe that if there was some sort of a program implemented, especially maybe the last year of high school, where these kids would get a full education on drinking, what drinking does, and then maybe get some sort of a learner's permit, a drinker's permit, if you will, so that way there was a certain amount of allowances based on an education rather than just getting these kids right at 21 where people end up dying or getting extremely hurt. And I understand the opposition when people say that, you know, the trickle-down effect, if you bring it to age 18, then younger and younger kids that are hanging out with these kids might be able to do so. But really, that's going to be the case no matter what it's at. 16-year-olds are going to drink if they have the opportunity or whatever. But if you think about the education trickle-down effect as well, if these kids at age 18, 19, whatever it is, are going to start actually educating themselves about what it means to drink, how much their bodies can actually handle, and so on, we'll probably end up seeing a lot more positive effects versus negative.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call. Christian?
Right, and that's kind of what I've been talking about with a drinking license. It would be contingent on taking some kind of education course, understanding what drinking is like and being responsible. Plus, it would help make up some of the revenue that would be lost from the federal funds. When I was 19, 20 years old, I certainly would pay $100 or whatever for a drinking license if I had to take a class. And again, it would keep the out-of-state kids from coming in here and drinking.
Christian, you've written this piece, but what would it take politically to get the ball rolling and lower the drinking age in Wisconsin?
For the entire legislature to be drunk, perhaps. I don't know. It doesn't seem very likely. It's funny that when you talk to people, you get a lot of support for the idea, but I don't know that there's a lot of the political will to do something like this. So. I think it's interesting to talk about, but I'm not holding out a whole lot of hope that it happens.
Christian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Christian Schneider. We've been talking about his column, Lowering the Drinking Age, in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Coming up, the NFL season is off and running, and we'll talk about the appeal of football and whether news about concussions and criminal charges might turn people away.
First, we saw a lot of news about solar flares over the last couple of weeks. That led us to call up Phil Plait to bring us up to date on the sun and on the northern lights.
Phil is an astronomer, and he writes the Bad Astronomy blog. Phil, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, I have to tell you, part of the reason you're here, okay, let's not lie, a huge chunk of the reason you're here is that Rob and I really want to see the Northern Lights. and I want to hear that it's going to be a good year for it.
Well, It hasn't been a bad year for it. There have been quite a few beautiful displays of aurora if you're far enough north. For me, I live in Boulder, Colorado, and it's just barely too south to see them unless something really spectacular happens.
Yeah, and as I understand it, so the northern lights, they are tied to the cycles of the sun and to solar flares. So can you unravel that a little bit and tell us what's going on with the sun and northern lights?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. The sun is basically a gigantic ball of gas. And inside the sun, where it's very hot, the atoms of this gas have their electrons stripped off. And what that means is that there are charged particles inside the sun moving up and down all the time. Now, you don't have to understand the science of this too carefully, but basically, when you have moving charged particles, you generate a magnetic field. And that's what's causing all of this stuff. As the particles move up towards the surface of the sun, these magnetic fields get very tangled up, and they're incredibly powerful. They store energy in them, and that energy can be released explosively. And because the sun is so huge, the amount of energy released can completely dwarf our entire arsenal of nuclear weapons on the Earth. When this happens, you get an explosion called a solar flare, and this blasts particles into space. They move across interplanetary space. They hit our magnetic field, which acts like a net and catches them, funnels them down to the north and south poles. They slam into our atmosphere and then light it up, kind of like a neon sign. So basically what you see on the ground is the northern lights. It has its origins deep inside the sun, which I think is pretty cool.
So what causes all the colors then with these particles?
Well, basically, it's just different stuff in the Earth's atmosphere. You can change the color of a neon sign. You can have it be red, green, all these different colors, depending on how much of each gas you put in the little glass tubes in the sign. And it's the same thing with the Earth's atmosphere. There's nitrogen and oxygen in our atmosphere, and these glow at different characteristic colors when they're slammed by these subatomic particles from the sun. So you can see mostly green. That's very common. But less commonly, you'll see red and purple and even pink, which is a mixture of some of the other colors that these molecules give off. I've never seen an aurora ever, really. So I can't describe what it looks like from my own personal experience. But from time-lapse photography and these beautiful photographs we see, they're completely spectacular, and I really want to see one.
Get in line, right? I don't know. I saw some green ones once, but I didn't have my contacts in, so they were a lot more blurry, and the people around me got a lot more out of it than I did. So I don't know. I'm still holding out hope that they will come back even greater than before. And so to that end, now I have heard that the sun moves in solar cycles, and that what we are in right now is a big solar cycle year, which means more solar flares. Is that true?
Yes, kind of. As always, the reality is a little more complicated. The sun does have a cycle to it where the magnetic field gets stronger and weaker over time, and we're about to hit the peak of that. This happens every 11 years. It happened back in 2002, 2003, something like that. It's happening now, and it's a fairly weak maximum right now, and the sun's acting a little oddly. It's different every time. So this isn't a huge shock, but it's interesting that it's not quite as strong as it was last time when it was just blasting out flares constantly. Right now, we're just getting a handful, and they're not necessarily that powerful. And so we'll see what happens over the next year or so as the sun figures out what exactly it's doing.
And I think you wrote about that some of these eruptions actually leave holes in the sun's corona. How long do they stay there?
Yeah, the sun has essentially what you can think of as an atmosphere. It's an extremely thin gas that surrounds it and extends out for millions of miles, in fact. And that's where a lot of these phenomena originate from. And if you can't see the corona very well using visible light, but if you use ultraviolet and X-rays, and we do have satellites that can see in those wavelengths, the corona becomes very obvious. And there are parts of it that have these holes in it. And it's kind of weird. It's almost as if the sun's atmosphere just weren't there in those spots. And those holes are where a lot of these particles stream away from. And they come and go over a matter of hours, days, weeks, things like that. And we don't really understand what causes them. The sun is fantastically complex. The physics is mind-blowing. And so we're still trying to figure that stuff out, which is why NASA launches all these fantastic satellites so that we can understand it. I mean, this is the source of our light and heat and all life on Earth. And so the sun is something we really need to understand better.
Now, in terms of, I guess, the magnetic polarity of the sun, do I have this right? The sun is going to reverse its polarity?
Yes, and it's not nearly as scary as it sounds.
Yeah, it sounds pretty scary.
Every 11 years, I know. There's a lot of conspiracy theories you can find online about this because it sounds like, you know, the sun's going to flip over or something like that. It's nothing like that. If you've ever taken a bar magnet in school and put a piece of paper on it and sprinkled iron filings on it, the iron filings will follow the magnetic field of the bar magnet, and there's a north and a south pole. And it turns out that you can flip those poles without physically flipping a magnet, and the sun does this every 11 years at the peak of its cycle. So we're going through that now. It'll probably flip over in the next few months. And on Earth, you wouldn't even notice it, really. I mean, it's just what it does all the time. So this isn't scary. It's actually a pretty cool physical phenomenon that, again, is not completely understood. This is very fierce physics, and we're still trying to figure it out. But it all leads toward understanding the sun better and how it interacts with the Earth. And since these phenomena like solar flares and these coronal mass ejections, a huge storm similar to flares, these can affect our satellites, these can affect our power grid, and so it's worth knowing more about them because they do have an effect on us here. And the more we know about them, the more we can protect ourselves against them.
Well, right. We've heard about solar flares, people being worried about solar storms affecting communications. And I've seen, you know, some articles where people are pretty worried about that kind of thing. Have we ever seen it come to pass like that, where the sun just pumps out so much energy that it really does interfere with the Earth's communication systems?
Actually, yes. The very first solar flare ever seen was in 1859, so 150 years ago. And it actually had physical effects on the Earth. Telegraphs were able to be used without batteries because of electricity flowing through the wires from this flare. All kinds of crazy effects. And in more modern times, in 1989, a large solar storm actually induced so much current, so much electricity flowing in the Earth's surface, that it overloaded the power grid in North America, and Canada had a brownout for several hours in the middle of March. So this can happen. We can protect ourselves from it by being aware of it, basically. The power companies could put in more overflow capacity for current in their system. The problem is that's hugely expensive, and this is a relatively rare event. My concern is that it's rare, but it's not never. It happened 20 years ago, and it happened 150 years ago, and it could happen again. And we should be taking this more seriously.
So, Phil, can we predict this stuff, or is it just kind of like weather on Earth? It's kind of a best guess kind of scenario.
Actually, it is a lot like weather on Earth. You can get a little bit of warning about some of this stuff. This activity is associated with sunspots, and when a sunspot grows very rapidly and has a very complex magnetic field, it's a fair bet that it's going to be something that's going to shoot out some solar storms. And it's also a little bit like climate. We can predict sort of, you know, next year in the winter it'll be cold, and next year in the summer it'll be hot. In the solar cycle, we know that it peaks and wanes over time. But for a specific event like this, it's extremely difficult to predict. We have to understand more. And so the more observations, the more people we have doing this stuff, the better. And happily, NASA and other organizations take it seriously.
Now, as the sun continues to grow older and to expand, are the flares that we've been talking about, are they going to get bigger as time goes on? And maybe, I guess this wouldn't be in our lifetimes, but might there be incredible, spectacular northern lights that I will not see, but maybe my great-great-great-grandchildren will?
I don't think so. Stars are very magnetically active when they're very young because they spin more quickly, and that spin helps power the magnetic field. As time goes on, the sun is actually slowing its spin very gradually. And the kind of changes you're talking about are over tens or hundreds of millions of years. So I don't think there's any difference you're going to see today versus, like, you know, 2 million A.D. So I don't think you have to worry about that.
All right, I won't mark my calendar then to look out for that. Well, I want to ask you, we're going toward the autumnal equinox. And I wonder, you know, to rely a bit on the astronomy side here, what are things that you're looking forward to seeing in the night sky as the constellations move, or as, you know, we move?
Well, nights are getting longer here in the Northern Hemisphere, so it's a better time for astronomy in general, just because you can go out earlier. Jupiter is going to start making its way into the night sky here in a couple of months. That's going to be nice. Saturn's up. Orion is up. earlier. So there are a lot of really beautiful things to see in the sky. If there's a local astronomy club, and you can find those online, just type in local astronomy club and see what it tells you. A lot of them will have star parties where you can go out and look through their telescopes, and that is never a bad time. That's always amazing to be able to see these things with your own eyes. So I strongly urge people to do that.
And did you happen to catch the Perseids when they were in our neck of the woods?
I always miss the Perseids. It's either cloudy or, in this case, I was in Australia, which is not the best place to see them from. But that's always good, too. There are lots and lots of meteor showers all the time. The next big one would probably be the Leonids in November and the Geminids in December. Although you guys are in Wisconsin, which is probably not practical to go out all night long in the winter.
It's possible.
But again, look up what meteor showers are going on, and sometimes it's worth going out and looking because, in a couple of hours you can see a dozen, two dozen meteors, and that's really something.
So you were down in Australia. I'm curious, what was it like to see, I guess, the whole different constellation when you looked up at the sky? As an astronomer, I imagine you sort of orient yourself based on what you see up there at night. What was it like being in Australia?
It was totally freaky. We live on this big ball, which is opaque, and when you go to the other hemisphere, there are stars down there that you can't see up here and vice versa. And I've been there before, but the weather wasn't that great, so I didn't see too many stars. But this time it was clear every night. So to see Orion upside down and the Southern Cross and even familiar constellations like Scorpius and Sagittarius, like totally overhead, almost straight up, as opposed to on the horizon, was very strange. it's like walking outside, and all of a sudden you realize the streets are all backwards. You can imagine how hard that would be to try to navigate.
Yeah.
So just walking outside and seeing unfamiliar stars in the sky, that's really weird.
Yeah. So is it something that you kind of have to pinch yourself and say, yeah, I'm still on planet Earth, I guess?
Yeah, and it's spectacular to be able to see, Alpha Centauri, which is the nearest star to the sun, but is completely invisible from up here in the United States, basically. That's fantastic. It's just knowing that. Just knowing it, just seeing that bright star and thinking, that's it. That's the closest star we can see. And right next to it is the Southern Cross and all these other fantastic constellations, which seem very exotic to us. But, of course, down there, they're like, oh, yeah, what do you think? It's wonderful. And I can't wait to be able to get down to the Southern Hemisphere again.
Excellent. Well, you're making me want to do the same. Phil, thank you so much for coming on and talking today.
Thank you.
That was astronomer Phil Plait. You can follow his work at the Bad Astronomy blog.